Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the Hour of the Time. Today, Wednesday, the 16th of January, February 2005. Now, before we get into the content of the show, I'd like to make the basic announcements. If you'd like to contact the Hour of the Time, you may do so by writing Hour of the Time, P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona, 85925. That's Hour of the Time, P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona, 85925. If you'd like to visit our website, a massive compilation of research materials, news updates, links, it is hourofthetime.com. That's hourofthetime.com. Now, if you'd like to email either myself or Rob, the co-host and webmaster, you may do so. Simply going to the link right at the top of the page or email me at hourofthetime@hotmail.com, hourofthetime@hotmail.com. Now, a phone number you should have is our studio line. We did put in that line based on audience request. There you can leave messages. It's also when we have the call-ins for guests or any other broadcast, it's the same number across the board. So if you want to call with some questions or share some research, anything like that, or during call-in shows, the number is 928-333-2942. That's 928-333-2942. Now, I must remind the listeners and viewers of our website and listeners of our broadcast for the Hour of the Time, that we rely on your donations for support and to keep the program going. Without your donations for research, for research materials, we cannot stay on the air. We cannot pay our phone bills, electrical bills, website, all that's entailed in this operation. And research costs a lot of money when you're trying to get copies or reprints of old materials, or even new stuff, and having to get the publications through different official entities' forms. Usually, they're not free. In fact, a lot of times they're incredibly expensive for what you get. I guess they partially fund their events and get-togethers through these massively priced booklets. So remember that. We need your support or we're not on the air, and we will shut it off. No ifs, ands, or buts. I've already talked to Alan about it. If that need arises, the Hour of the Time will be gone, and it will be the listening audience and the viewing audience of the website's fault. Okay? We have done everything on our side to keep this operation going. Now, those of you who have helped out time and time and time again, one time, whatever, you know who you are, and you know that this is not addressed to you. Those of you who want to sit back and take advantage of the radio program and all the free information on the website, you are the guilty party. So sit back and think about that. And if you want to let the number one thorn in the side of the New World Order fall apart just due to your lack of participation, then I think you're going to feel really bad trying to explain to people down the road how certain events in this country came about when they start asking you well, why didn't we know it can't happen here, etc. Now, I have a couple pieces to go over today. One of them is going to be a two-part, at least, series of broadcasts. It's from a very old publication written by a highly decorated soldier, Marine, I should say. They don't like to be referred to as just soldiers. The other piece is not meant to be humorous, but it's humorous in an insightful way. This first one is basically the resume of Jesus Christ. His address is Ephesians 1:20, phone Romans 10:13, and his website is thebible.com. Keywords are Christ, Lord, Savior, and Jesus. Now, hello, my name is Jesus the Christ. Call me Lord. I've sent you my resume because I'm seeking the top management position in your heart. Please consider my accomplishments as set forth in my resume. I breathe into man the breath of life. I redeem man from the curse of the law. Occupational background? I've only had one employer. See Luke 2:49. I've never been tardy, absent, disobedient, slothful, or disrespectful. My employer has nothing but rave reviews for me. See Matthew 3:15-17. Skills and work experience. Some of my skills and work experiences include empowering the poor to be poor no more, healing the brokenhearted, setting the captives free, healing the sick, restoring sight to the blind, and setting at liberty them that are bruised. See Luke 4:18. I'm a wonderful counselor. See Isaiah 9:6. People who listen to me shall dwell safely and shall not fear evil. See Proverbs 1:33. Most importantly, I have the authority, ability, and power to cleanse you of your sins. See 1 John 1:7-9. My educational background? I encompass the entire breadth and length of knowledge, wisdom, and understanding. See Proverbs 2:6. In me are hid all of the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. See Colossians 2:3. My word is so powerful, it has been described as being a lamp under your feet and a lamp under your path. See Psalms 119:105. I can tell you all the secrets of your heart. See Psalms 44:21. My major accomplishments include, I was an active participant in the greatest summit meeting of all times. Genesis 1:26. I laid down my life so that you may live. See 2 Corinthians 5:15. I defeated the archenemy of God and mankind and made show of them openly. See Colossians 2:15. I miraculously fed the poor, healed the sick, and raised the dead. There are many more major accomplishments, too many to mention here. You can read them on my website, which is located at www.thebible. You don't need an internet connection or computer access for my website. My references are believers and followers worldwide will testify to my divine healing, salvation, deliverance, miracles, restoration, and supernatural guidance. In summation, now that you've read my resume, I'm confident that I'm the only candidate uniquely qualified to fill this vital position in your heart. In summation, I will properly direct your path, see Proverbs 3:5-6, and lead you into everlasting life, see John 6:47. When can I start? Time is of the essence, see Hebrews 3:15.
Down.
right, ladies and gentlemen, we're back to another live broadcast today, the 16th of January, February 2005. I was using a calendar to figure out a date, and I changed the page back to January, and that's what's right in front of me on the wall. So I will have to change that, obviously. Now, it is February. Today, I'm going to read, basically, it was a short booklet that a gentleman in our research audience sent this to me, and it was funny how he relayed the story that he had had it for a long, long time and had forgot about it and recently read it, and how telling of the times it was, or important it was, considering now, especially when you hear the age of the writing. And it was kind of funny how he stumbled across it, because I forgot I had it. It's one of those books that is very good. Small, you read it, you absorb it, and then just kind of lay it back in a box somewhere. So I do have a link for that where it's available on the internet. The entire thing, it's real, not much to print out and read. It can be read in one sitting, 13 pages, in fact. The only corrections I have based on the internet version is this, and it's under his, basically, events that he did throughout his life, his resume, per se. This gentleman, Smedley Darlington Butler, wrote this excellent book. So I really want you to pay attention for the next day or two to this. That's what it'll take to do it on the air. He was well ahead of his time and should be listened to based on his accomplishments and ranks and abilities. And it's a very telling piece. He was a major general in the United States Marine Corps, retired. He was born in Westchester, Pennsylvania, July 30th, 1881. Educated at Haverford School. He married his wife, Ethel C. Peters of Philadelphia, June 30th, 1905. Get this, ladies and gentlemen. He was awarded 2 Congressional Medals of Honor. That's the highest award that can be earned for valor in combat. To earn 1 is absolutely incredible. To get him to earn 1 and receive it alive still is even more incredible, and to have earned 2 of them and still be alive and wear them is rare in the history of the United States military since the inception of the Congressional Medal of Honor. I believe there was only 19 double recipients ever. Now, they do say on the web version that they were awarded for the capture of Veracruz, Mexico, and for the capture of Fort Riviera, Haiti. That is correct. But according to my research, based on the Society for the Winners of the Congressional Medal of Honor, the years are incorrect in the web version. They list them as 14 and 17. They're actually, according to the National Congressional Medal of Honor Society, they were both earned in 1915. Now, he also a Distinguished Service Medal, which is incredible in and of itself. He retired October 1, 1931. On leave of absence, he acted as Director of Department of Safety for Philadelphia in 1932. He lectured throughout the 30s. And that's how I came across this book, with someone that collected simply lectures from historical people. And that's how I got my version of this, and had forgotten about it, like the gentleman that sent it to me yesterday that corresponds with me quite a bit. He was a Republican candidate for Senate in 1932. He died at the Naval Hospital in Philadelphia, June 21, 1940. For further information, as far as the web link that I have is concerned, you can, about Major General Smedley Butler, if you can contact the United States Marine Corps site. I would suggest, though, just going to the Congressional Medal of Honor Society site, because they give you a lot of good background there, and it's a lot easier to sift through than, obviously, the United States Marine Corps site. This is an excellent piece, and very meaningful in the times that we're in, especially when we look at when it was written, and look at his accomplishments. The words are not to be taken lightly. Now, I'm going to read the piece in its entirety. If I diverge from the piece, I will let you know. Again, if you would like to contact me at houratatime@hotmail.com, I'll gladly send you the link I have where this can be downloaded. So if you'd like to read it at your leisure as well. Of course, I would like you to donate to purchase the audio tape of it to help keep Hour of the Time on the air, but we need to get the information out there as well. The piece, War is a Racket, Chapter 1. War is a racket. It always has been. It is possibly the oldest, easiestly the most profitable, surely the most vicious. It is the only international in scope. It is the only one in which the profits are reckoned in dollars and the losses in lives. A racket is best described, I believe, as something that is not what it seems to the majority of the people. Only a small, inside group knows what it is about. It is conducted for the benefit of the very few, at the expense of the very many. Out of war, a few people make huge fortunes. In the World War, that is one, a mere handful garnered the profits of the conflict. At least 21,000 new millionaires and billionaires were made in the United States during the World War. That many admitted their huge blood gains and their income tax returns. How many other war millionaires falsified their tax returns, no one knows. As an aside from the piece, ladies and gentlemen, think about that. Just the honestly reported new millionaires and billionaires by the end of the fiscal year 1917 exceeded 21,000 off the profits of World War I. Back to the piece. How many of these war millionaires shouldered a rifle? How many of them dug a trench? How many of them knew what it meant to go hungry in a rat-infested dugout? How many of them spent sleepless, frightened nights ducking shells and shrapnel and machine gun bullets? How many of them parried a bayonet thrust of an enemy? How many of them were wounded or killed in battle? Out-of-war nations acquire additional territory if they are victorious. They just take it. This newly acquired territory promptly is exploited by the few. The self-same few who wrung dollars out of blood in the war. The general public shoulders the bill. And what is the bill? This bill renders a horrible accounting. Newly placed gravestones, mangled bodies, shattered minds, broken hearts and homes, economic instability, depression and all its attendant miseries, back-breaking taxation for generations and generations. For a great many years as a soldier, I had a suspicion that war was a racket. Not until I retired to civil life did I fully realize it. Now that I see the international war clouds gathering as they are today, I must face it and speak out. Again, they are choosing sides. France and Russia met and agreed to stand side by side. Italy and Austria hurried to make a similar agreement. Poland and Germany cast sheep's eyes at each other, forgetting, for the nonce, once unique occasion, their dispute over the Polish corridor. The assassination of King Alexander of Yugoslavia complicated matters. Yugoslavia and Hungary, long bitter enemies, were almost at each other's throats. Italy was ready to jump in, but France was waiting. So was Czechoslovakia. All of them are looking ahead to war. Not the people, not those who fight and pay and die. Only those who foment wars and remain safely at home to profit. There are 40 million men under arms in the world today, and our statesmen and diplomats have the temerity to say that war is not in the making. Hell's bells. Are these 40 million men being trained to be dancers? Not in Italy, to be sure. Premier Mussolini knows what they are being trained for. He, at least, is frank enough to speak out. Only the other day, Il Duce, an international consolation, the publication of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, said, above all, fascism, the more it considers and observes the future and the development of humanity quite apart from political considerations of the moment, believes neither in the possibility nor the utility of perpetual peace. War alone brings up to its highest tension all human energy and puts the stamp of nobility upon the people who have the courage to meet it. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to repeat that. Pay attention to where it was published and to what he said. Premier Mussolini knows what they are being trained for. He at least is frank enough to speak out. Only the other day, Il Duce, in the International Consolation, the publication of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, said, "And above all, fascism, the more it considers and observes the future and the development of humanity quite apart from political considerations of the moment, believes neither in the possibility nor the utility of perpetual peace. War alone brings up to its highest tension all human energy and puts the stamp of nobility upon the people who have the courage to meet it." Undoubtedly, Mussolini means exactly what he says. His well-trained army, his great fleet of planes, and even his navy are ready for war, anxious for it, apparently. His recent stand at the side of Hungary in the latter's dispute with Yugoslavia showed that. And the hurried mobilization of his troops on the Austrian border after the assassination of Dollfuss showed it, too. There are others in Europe, too, whose saber-rattling presages war sooner or later. Herr Hitler, with his remaining Germany and his constant demands for more and more arms, as an equal, if not greater, menace to peace. France only recently increased the term of military service for its youth from a year to 18 months. Yes, all over, nations are camping in their arms. The mad dogs of Europe are on the loose. In the Orient, the maneuvering is more adroit. Back in 1904, when Russia and Japan fought, we kicked out our old friends, the Russians, and backed Japan. Then our very generous international bankers were financing Japan. Now the trend is to poison us against the Japanese. What does the, quote, open-door policy to China mean to us? Our trade with China is about $90 million a year. Or the Philippine Islands. We have spent about $600 million in the Philippines in 35 years. And we, that is, our bankers and industrialists and speculators, have private investments there of less than $200 million. Then, to save that Chinese trade of about $90 million or protect these private investments of less than $200 million in the Philippines, we would be all stirred up to hate Japan and go to war, a war that might well cost us tens of billions of dollars, hundreds of thousands of lives of Americans, and many more hundreds of thousands of physically maimed and mentally unbalanced men. Of course, for this loss, there would be a compensating profit. Fortunes would be made. Millions and billions of dollars would be piled up by a few. Munitions makers, bankers, shipbuilders, manufacturers, meat packers, speculators, they would fare well. Yes, they are getting ready for another war. Why shouldn't they? It pays high dividends. But what does it profit the men who are killed? What does it profit their mothers and sisters, their wives and their sweethearts? What does it profit their children? What does it profit anyone except the very few to whom war means huge profits? Yes, and what does it profit the nation? Take our own case. Until 1898, we didn't own a bit of territory outside the mainland of North America. At that time, our national debt was little more than $1 billion. Then we became, quote, internationally minded. We forgot or shunted aside the advice of the father of our country. We forgot George Washington's warnings about, quote, entangling alliances. We went to war. We acquired outside territory. At the end of the World War period, as a direct result of our fiddling in international affairs, our national debt had jumped to $25 billion. Our total favorable trade balance during the 25-year period was about $24 billion. Therefore, on a purely bookkeeping basis, we ran a little behind year for year, and that foreign trade might well have been ours without the wars. It would have been far cheaper not to say safer for the average American who pays the bills to stay out of foreign entanglements. For a very few, this racket, like bootlegging and other underworld rackets, brings fancy profits. But the cost of operations is always transferred to the people who do not profit. Chapter 2. Who makes the profits? The World War, rather our brief participation in it, has cost the United States some $52 billion, figured out. That means $400 to every American man, woman, and child. And we haven't paid the debt yet. We are paying it, our children will pay it, and our children's children probably still will be paying the cost of that war. The normal profits of a business concerning the United States are 6, 8, 10, and sometimes 12%. But wartime profits, that is another matter. 20, 60, 100, 300, and even 1,800%. The sky is the limit. All that traffic will bear. Uncle Sam has the money. Let's get it. Of course, it isn't put that crudely in wartime. It is dressed into speeches about patriotism, love of country, and, quote, we must all put our shoulders to the wheel, end quote. But the profits jump and leap and skyrocket and are safely pocketed. Let's just take a few examples. Take our friends the DuPonts, the powder people. Didn't one of them testify before a Senate committee recently that their powder won the war? Or saved the world for so-called democracy or something? How did they do in the war? They were a patriotic corporation. Well, the average earnings of the DuPonts for the period 1910 to 1914 were $6 million a year. It wasn't much, but the DuPonts managed to get along on it. Now let's look at their average yearly profits during the war years, 1914 to 1918. $58 million a year profit, we find. Nearly 10 times that of normal times, and the profit in normal times were pretty good. An increase in profits of more than 950%. Take one of our little field companies that patriotically shunted aside the making of rails and girders and bridges to manufacture war materials. Well, their 1910 to 1914 yearly earnings averaged $6 million. Then came the war, and like loyal citizens, Bethlehem Steel promptly turned to ammunitions making. Did their profits jump, or did they let Uncle Sam in for a bargain? Well, their 1914 to 1918 average was $49 million a year. If you'd like to contact the Hour of the Time, you may do so by writing P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona, 85925. If you'd like to visit our massively documented website of research materials, it is hourofthetime.com. And to email me, it is hourofthetime@hotmail.com. If you'd like to call to leave inquiries and questions and share research, and also during call-in shows, the number is 928-333-2942. And remember, the Hour of the Time, our broadcast every day live on WBCQ and our website and our research endeavors rely upon your donations. We have a massive amount of research material available for your donations. So I would hope you'd find it within yourself to help keep this research going. Now back to the piece, War is a Racket, written by, Smedley Darlington Butler, Major General, United States Marine Corps, and twice over winner of the Congressional Medal of Honor. Now, let's take United States Steel. The normal earnings during the five-year period prior to the war were $105 million a year. Not bad. Then came along the war, and up went the profits. The average yearly profit for the period 1914 to 1918 was $240 million. Not bad. Then you have some of the steel and powder earnings. Let's look at something else. A little copper, perhaps. That always does well in war times. Anaconda, for instance. Average yearly earnings during the pre-war years, 1910 to 1914, of $10 million. During the war years, 1914 to 1918, profits leaped $34 million per year. Or Utah copper. Average of $5 million per year during 1910-1914 period. Jumped to an average of $21 million yearly profits for the war period. Now, let's group these five with three smaller companies. The total yearly average profits of the pre-war period, 1910 to 1914, were $137,480,000. Then along came the war. The average yearly profits for this group skyrocketed to $408,300,000. A little increase in profits of approximately 200%. Does war pay? Well, it paid for them, but they aren't the only ones. There are still others. Let's take leather. For the three-year period before the war, the total profits of Central Leather Company were $3,500,000. That was approximately $1,167,000 a year. Well, in 1916, Central Leather returned a profit of $15 million, a small profit, an increase of 1,100%. That's all. Then, the General Chemical Company averaged a profit for the 3 years before the war of a little over $800,000 a year. Came the war and the profits jumped to $12 million. A leap of 1,400%. International Nickel Company, and you certainly can't have a war without nickel, showed an increase in profits from a mere average of $4 million a year to $73 million yearly. Not bad. An increase of more than 1,700%. American Sugar Refining Company averaged $2 million a year for the 3 years before the war. In 1916, a profit of $6 million was recorded. Listen to Senate Document Number 259, the 65th Congress reporting on corporate earnings and government revenues. Considering the profits of 122 meat packers, 153 cotton manufacturers, 299 garment makers, 49 steel plants, and 340 coal producers during the war. Profits under 25% were exceptional. For instance, the coal companies made between 100% and 7,856% on their capital stock during the war. The Chicago Packers doubled and tripled their earnings. And let us not forget the bankers who financed the Great War. If anyone had the cream of the profit, it was the bankers. Being partnerships rather than incorporated organizations, they do not have to report to stockholders, and their profits were as secret as they were immense. How the bankers made their millions and their billions, I do not know, because those little secrets never become public, even before a Senate investigatory body. But here's how some of the other patriotic industrialists and speculators chiseled their way into war profits. Take the shoe people. They like war. It brings business with abnormal profits. They made huge profits on sales abroad to our allies. Perhaps, like the munitions manufacturers and armament makers, they also sold to the enemy. For a dollar is a dollar, whether it comes from Germany or from France. but they did well by Uncle Sam, too. For instance, they sold Uncle Sam 35 million pairs of hobnailed service shoes. There were 4 million soldiers. 8 pairs or more to a soldier? My regiment during the war had only 1 pair to a soldier. Some of these shoes probably are still in existence. They were good shoes. But when the war was over, Uncle Sam has a matter of 25 million pairs left over, bought and paid for, profits recorded and pocketed. There was still lots of leather left. So the leather people sold your Uncle Sam hundreds of thousands of McClellan saddles for the cavalry. But there wasn't any American cavalry overseas. Somebody had to get rid of this leather, however. Somebody had to make a profit in it. So we had a lot of McClellan saddles. And we probably have those yet. Also, somebody had a lot of mosquito netting. They sold your Uncle Sam 20 million mosquito nets for the use of the soldiers overseas. I suppose the boys were expected to put it over them as they tried to sleep in muddy trenches, one hand scratching cooties on their backs, the other making passes at scurrying rats. Well, not one of those mosquito nets ever got to France. Anyhow, these thoughtful manufacturers wanted to make sure that no soldier would be without his mosquito net. So, 40 million additional yards of mosquito netting were sold to Uncle Sam. There were pretty good profits in mosquito netting in those days, even if there were no mosquitoes in France. I suppose if the war had lasted just a little longer, the enterprising mosquito netting manufacturers would have sold your Uncle Sam a couple of consignments of mosquitoes to plant in France so that more mosquito netting would be in order. Airplane and engine manufacturers felt they too should get their just profits out of this war. Why not? Everybody else was getting theirs. So, $1 billion, count them if you live long enough, was spent by Uncle Sam in building airplane engines that never left the ground. Not one plane or motor out of the $1 billion worth ordered ever got into a battle in France. Just the same, the manufacturers made their little profit of 30, 100, or perhaps 300%. Undershirts for soldiers cost 14 cents to make, and Uncle Sam paid 30 to 40 cents each for them. A nice little profit for the undershirt manufacturer. And the stocking manufacturer, and the uniform manufacturers, and the cap manufacturers, and the steel helmet manufacturers all got theirs. Why, when the war was over, some 4 million sets of equipment, knapsacks and the things that go to fill them, crammed warehouses on this side. Now they are being scrapped because the regulations have changed the contents. But the manufacturers collected their wartime profits on them, and they will do it all over again the next time. There were lots of brilliant ideas for profit-making during the war. One very versatile patriot sold Uncle Sam 12 dozen 48-inch wrenches. Oh, they were very nice wrenches. The only trouble was that there was only one nut ever made that was huge enough for these wrenches. That is the one that holds the turbines at Niagara Falls. Well, after Uncle Sam had bought them and the manufacturer had pocketed the profit, the wrenches were put on freight cars and shunted all around the United States in an effort to find a use for them. When the armistice was signed, it was indeed a sad blow to the wrench manufacturer. He was just about to make some nuts to fit the wrenches. Then he planned to sell these, too, to your Uncle Sam. Still another had the brilliant idea that colonels shouldn't ride in automobiles, nor should they even ride on horseback. One has probably seen a picture of Andy Jackson riding in a buckboard. Well, some 6,000 buckboards were sold to Uncle Sam for the use of colonels. Not one of them was used. But the buckboard manufacturers got his war profit. The shipbuilders felt they should come in on some of it too. They built a lot of ships that made a lot of profit, more than $3 billion worth. Some of the ships were all right, but the $635 million worth of them were made of wood and wouldn't float. The seams opened up and they sank. We paid for them, though, and somebody pocketed the profits. It has been estimated by statisticians and economists and researchers that the war cost your Uncle Sam $52 billion. Of this sum, $39 billion was expended in the actual war itself. This expenditure yielded $16 billion in profit. That is how the 21,000 billionaires and millionaires got that way. This $16 billion profits is not to be sneezed at. It is quite a tidy sum, and it went to a very few. The Senate, the Nye Committee, probed the munitions industry and its wartime profits, despite its sensational disclosures, hardly a scratch the surface. Even so, it has had some effect. The State Department has been studying, quote, for some time, end quote, methods of keeping out of war. The War Department suddenly decides it has a wonderful plan to spring. The administration names a committee, with the War and Navy Departments ably represented under chairmanship of a Wall Street speculator, to limit profits in wartime. To what extent isn't suggested? Possibly the profits of 300 and 600 and 1600% of those who turned blood into gold in the World War would be limited to some smaller figure. Apparently, however, the plan does not call for any limitation of losses. That is, the losses of those who fight the war. As far as I have been able to ascertain, there is nothing in the scheme to limit a soldier to the loss of but one eye or one arm, or to limit his wounds to one or two or three, or to limit the loss of life. There is nothing in the scheme, apparently, that says not more than 12% of a regiment shall be wounded in battle, or that not more than 7% in a division shall be killed. Of course, the committee cannot be bothered with such trifling matters. Chapter 3. Who pays the bills? Who provides the profits? These nice little profits of 20, 100, 300, 1500, and 1800%. We all pay them in taxation. We paid the bankers their profits when we bought Liberty bonds at $100 and sold them back at $84 or $86 to the bankers. These bankers collected $100 plus. It was a simple manipulation. The bankers controlled the security marts. It was easy for them to depress the price of these bonds. Then all of us, the people, got frightened and sold the bonds at $84 or $86. The bankers bought them. Then these same bankers stimulated a boom and government bonds went to par and above. Then the bankers collected their profits. But the soldier pays the biggest part of the bill. If you don't believe this, visit the American cemeteries on the battlefields abroad, or visit any of the veterans' hospitals in the United States. On a tour of the country, in the midst of which I am at the time of this writing, I have visited 18 government hospitals for veterans. In them are a total of about 50,000 destroyed men. Men who were the pick of the nation 18 years ago. The very able chief surgeon at the government hospital at Milwaukee, where there are 3,800 of the living dead, told me that mortality among veterans is three times as great as among those who stayed at home. Boys with a normal viewpoint were taken out of the fields and offices and factories and classrooms and put into the ranks. There they were remolded. They were made over. They were made to about face, to regard murder as the order of the day. They were put shoulder to shoulder, and through mass psychology, they were entirely changed. We use them for a couple years and train them to think nothing at all of killing or of being killed. Then, suddenly, we discharge them and told them to make another about face. This time they had to do their own readjustment. Sans mass psychology, sans officer's aid and advice, sans nationwide propaganda. We didn't need them anymore, so we scattered them about without any 3-minute or Liberty Loan speeches or parades. Many, too many of these fine young boys are eventually destroyed mentally because they could not make the final about-face alone. In the governmental hospital in Marion, Indiana, 1,800 of these boys are in pens, 500 of them in a barracks with steel bars and wires all around outside the buildings and on the porches. These already have been mentally destroyed. These boys don't even look like a human being. Oh, the looks on their faces. Physically, they are in good shape. Mentally, they are gone. There are thousands and thousands of these cases, and more are coming in all the time. The tremendous excitement of the war, the sudden cutting off of that excitement, the young boys couldn't stand it. That's a part of the bill. So much for the dead, they have paid their part of the war profits. So much for the mentally and physically wounded, they are paying now their share of the war profits. But the others paid too. They paid with heartbreaks when they tore themselves away from their firesides and their families to don the uniform of Uncle Sam, on which a profit had been made. They paid another part in the training camps, where they were regimented and drilled while others took their jobs and their places and their lives of their communities. They paid for it in the trenches, where they were shot and were shot. Where they were hungry for days at a time. Where they slept in the mud and the cold and in the rain with the moans and shrieks of the dying for a horrible lullaby. But don't forget, the soldier paid part of the dollars and cents bill too. Up to and including the Spanish-American War, we had a prize system and soldiers and sailors fought for money. During the Civil War, they were paid bonuses, in many instances, before they went into service. The government, or states, paid as high as $1,200 for an enlistment. In the Spanish-American War, they gave prize money. When we captured any vessel, the soldiers all got their share. At least they were supposed to. Then it was found that we could reduce the cost of wars by taking all the prize money and keeping it, but conscripting or drafting the soldier anyway. Then soldiers couldn't bargain for their labor. Everyone else could bargain, but the soldier couldn't. Napoleon once said, "All men are enamored of decorations. They positively hunger for them." So, by developing the Napoleonic system, the medal business, the government learned it could get soldiers for less money because the boys liked to be decorated. Until the Civil War, there were no medals. Then the Congressional Medal of Honor was handed out. It made enlistments easier. After the Civil War, no new medals were issued until the Spanish-American War. In the World War, we used propaganda to make the boys accept conscription. They were made to feel ashamed if they didn't join the army. So vicious was this propaganda that even God was brought into it. With few exceptions, our clergymen joined in the clamor to kill, kill, kill. Kill the Germans. God is on our side. It is His will that the Germans be killed. And in Germany, the good pastors called upon the Germans to kill the Allies, to please the same God. That was a part of the general propaganda, built up to make people war conscious and murder conscious. Beautiful ideas were painted for our boys who were sent out to die. This was the so-called war to end all wars. This was a so-called war to make the world safe for democracy. No one mentioned to them as they marched away that their going and dying would mean huge war profits. No one told these American soldiers that they might be shot down by bullets made by their own brothers here. No one told them that the ships on which they were going to cross might be torpedoed by submarines built with United States patents. They were just told it was to be a glorious adventure. Thus, having stuffed patriotism down their throats, it was decided to make them help pay for the war, too. So we gave them the large salary of $30 a month. All they had to do for this munificent sum was to leave their dear loved ones, give up their jobs, lie in swampy trenches, eat canned willy when they could get it, and kill and kill and kill and be killed. But wait, half of that wage, just a little more than a riveter in a shipyard or a laborer in a munitions factory safe at home, made in a day, was promptly taken from him to support his dependents, so that they would not become a charge upon his community. Then we made him pay what amounted to accident insurance, something the employer pays for in an enlightened state, and that cost him $6 a month. He had less than $9 a month left. Then, the most crowning insolence of all, he was virtually blackjacked into paying for his own ammunition, clothing, and food by being made to buy Liberty Bonds. Most soldiers got no money at all on paydays. We made them buy Liberty Bonds at $100, and then we bought them back when they came back from the war and couldn't find work at $84 and $86. And the soldiers bought about $2 billion worth of these bonds. Yes, the soldier pays the greater part of the bill. His family pays too. They paid in the same heartbreak that he does. As he suffers, they suffer. At nights, as he lay in the trenches and watched shrapnel burst about him, they lay home in their beds and toss sleeplessly. His father, his mother, his wife, his sisters, his brothers, his sons, and his daughters. When he returned home minus an eye, or minus a leg, or with his mind broken, they suffered too. As much as, and even sometimes more than he. Yes, and they too contributed their dollars to the profits of the munitions makers, and bankers, and shipbuilders, and the manufacturers, and the speculators made. They too bought Liberty Bonds and contributed to the profit of the bankers after the armistice in the hocus-pocus of manipulated Liberty Bond prices. And even now, the families of the wounded men and of the mentally broken and those who never were able to readjust themselves are still suffering and still paying. Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to the Hour of the Time on WBCQ The Planet, 7.415 megahertz and 9.330 megahertz out of Monticello, Maine. If you'd like to contact the Hour of the Time, you may do so by writing P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona, 85925. You can email me at hourofthetime@hotmail.com. And our website, a massive research website, is hourofthetime.com. Today, the 16th of February, there I did it again, 2005. And I hope everyone tunes in every day for more exciting broadcasts. We will continue the War is a Racket piece tomorrow with some other new financial tidbits on the new war out of the World Economic Forum. And remember, the Hour of the Time stays on the air and continues our research and the website and our functions at trying to restore a constitutional republic through your donations. You can look at our catalog on the website, and we have PayPal as an option. If there's an item without a button next to it, simply go to the Make a Donation PayPal right on the top front, and in the comments, just tell us the items you would like, because all the prices are listed. We also have the regular hard catalog. $5 will get you that first-class mail. Just send the money to the Eager address, P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona 85925, and I'll shoot you off a catalog immediately. Many of you out there have gotten them, and I think are quite happy with the finished product, the quality of it, the layout of it, and I hope you take advantage of these opportunities to share in the research and keep this program going. Again, thank you for tuning in today to the Hour of the Time, and be sure to tune in every day. God bless you, and have a good evening.
At last, everything is done for you.